The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about life on outcast planets. Dave, what makes a planet an outcast planet?
Well, that's a good question, Rob. It's not that this planet has done anything to annoy its friends. It's that this planet was actually slingshotted out of its planetary system, likely by gravitational interactions with other large worlds. And these planets are destined to wander the lonely cosmos as they slowly freeze.
And life on these planets without any light?
Well, it certainly doesn't sound like a very habitable place to be. You're on this planet in the middle of cold, dark space, and everything's frozen. But what scientists propose in this new paper is that actually this could be an environment where life could flourish. And the reason they say that is because imagine one of these outcast planets, but imagine this planet has an ocean, maybe an ocean much like Earth's. Well, that ocean's obviously going to freeze as this planet gets away from its sun. But what the researchers say in this paper is that they've done some modeling, and their modeling suggests that these planets, if they're large enough, can actually have a lot of geothermal activity going on. And this frozen ocean could actually help matters because you've got this heating from below, you've got this insulation from above with this very thick layer of ice, and in between you could actually have a relatively warm and liquid ocean where life could potentially thrive.
So not photosynthetic activity, but chemosynthetic activity. They're living off the elements coming out of the planet's magma or something like that.
Well, right. There's actually organisms like that on Earth, too, that actually live not via photosynthesis, but actually survive off chemicals in the deep, dark oceans. And that's obviously a possibility here. You know, this is all very speculative at this point. What's exciting about this study is that, you know, usually when we're looking for extraterrestrial life, we're looking at these solar systems that can be millions of light years away. What's exciting about this possibility of a rogue planet is that some of these rogue planets could theoretically be closer than a lot of these star systems that we're looking at. And actually, as an aside, that's an intriguing possibility for how life may have started on Earth. Some scientists have theorized that a rogue planet may have crashed into our solar system billions of years ago, possibly seeding it with early life.
But without a star illuminating this planet, how would we ever see it or detect it?
Well, it's a good question, Robin. The astronomers say we could potentially pick these planets up. It would have to be really close by looking for their infrared emissions. And that's possible with some of the telescopes we have today, although it's not very probable. The scientists say that there's only about a 1 in a billion chance that we're going to find one of these worlds with the current technology. But it does still raise the intriguing possibility that the first world besides Earth that we find with life may not actually be one orbiting a star, but maybe one just sort of wandering out there by itself in space.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from outer space to inner space, this next story is about what's actually going on in our nose when we smell odors.
What's actually going on? Some new hypothesis then.
Exactly. Well, the standard hypothesis for how we smell odors is that every odor molecule has a specific shape, and we have these receptors in our nose that detect these molecules. And the idea has been what scientists call a lock and key hypothesis. And basically what that means is that a specific shape molecule fits into a specific shape receptor. And once that happens, we smell a smell like fresh flowers or burnt coffee. But there's a couple problems with this hypothesis. The first problem is that we can detect tens of thousands of different odors, yet we only have a few hundred receptors for these odors in our nose. So the math doesn't really seem to work out. The second problem is that a lot of odor molecules are very similarly shaped, almost identical to each other. For example, the odor molecule that gives us the smell of vodka is virtually identical to the one that gives us a smell of rotten eggs. And you would expect if the shapes are so similar that they would activate the same receptor and give us the same smell. So there's some unanswered questions here. And that's where this new study comes in. These researchers in this new study are proposing that the way we smell really doesn't have much to do with a lock and key as much as it has to do with vibrations.
So even though the molecule for the smell of vodka is similar to the one for rotten eggs, they vibrate differently.
That's the idea. And physicists already know this. They know that molecules vibrate at specific frequencies. They even know that very similar molecules, even if they're almost identical, they can actually vibrate at very different frequencies. And that would help start to explain what might be going on in our nose, at least address that second problem with the lock and key hypothesis that very similar molecules can cause very different odor sensations. So it's an interesting hypothesis. And the way the researchers went about trying to prove it was they focused on fruit flies or Drosophila. And the reason they chose flies is because when you're testing humans, humans bring a lot of subjective experiences to the table about, oh, this smells like this and this smells like this. Well, flies, as far as we know, tend to be a lot less subjective. What they did was they put these flies in a maze, and there were two different arms of this maze, and the flies could choose to go into one arm or the other. And into each arm, these researchers pumped nearly identical odors. In fact, one of the molecules they used, the atomic structure was exactly the same, except that instead of a few of the hydrogens, there were deuteriums, which were basically exactly the same as hydrogen. They're just a little bit heavier. So you're talking about nearly identical molecules. And what they found was, even though these molecules were nearly identical, same shape, same structure, same almost everything, the flies displayed a strong preference for one odor over the other. They spent a lot more time in the part of the maze that one odor was pumped in over the other. And that suggests to the researchers that this vibration hypothesis has some validity, because how else could the flies be telling the difference between these two odors?
So what will really clinch it? What other evidence do they need?
Well, as you can imagine, this is a very controversial idea. In fact, it flies in the face of over 100 years of physiological research. So not everybody's very quick to embrace this. And the experts that are quoted in this article say that, you know, they'd like to see much more detailed studies done. They say it's an intriguing idea, but dramatic claims require dramatic evidence, and they don't feel like this evidence is dramatic enough to rule out the lock and key or even to support this vibration theory. But one cool thing about it is, if this is really true, or even if it's at least partially true, it could really help scientists who are trying to develop these artificial noses to sense things like food quality and even sniff out explosives. And the better we know how our own nose works, the better we can design these artificial noses.
Okay, so last one. What's this last story about?
Well, Rob, from the tiny molecules that give us our sense of smell to the tiny bacteria that cause human disease, this last story is about a bacterium called Staphylococcus aureus. And this is one of the most deadly killers of humans. In fact, it kills more people in the U.S. every year than HIV/AIDS does. And part of the problem is that this bug is very resistant to antibiotics. So every time doctors try to treat it with drugs, it evolves resistance and it comes back even stronger than before.
Right. I've read about at least one of them, MRSA, right? The methicillin-resistant.
Right. Methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. This is a huge problem in hospitals. It can contaminate equipment, very hard to get rid of. And so scientists obviously are trying to develop new antibiotics, but they also have to develop new strategies for combating these bugs. And this last study is about one of those new strategies. It targets something that the bug needs to do in order to survive. And surprisingly, that thing is recycling.
What's it recycling?
Well, it's recycling RNA. And RNA is basically our cellular blueprints. It's what the cell uses to turn the instructions from DNA into proteins, and the proteins that basically run the cell and run our bodies. And even bacteria use RNA, and they recycle RNA just like we do. And the reason we all recycle RNA, it's just much more efficient. You've got all these blueprints and you've got to create new blueprints. Why not just chop these blueprints up and fashion them into new blueprints rather than having to go back to the drawing board and create new ones? So in this new study, the researchers said, if we can throw a wrench in this recycling process, we can kill these bacteria, because they're going to waste a lot of time making new blueprints, or they actually won't be able to do anything at all because they won't be able to recycle and they won't have the raw material to create new RNA, and then they'll die.
Sounds like this could throw a wrench in any cell's ability, though, to recycle RNA.
Well, that's a good question. And obviously, when you're developing any drug that would do this, that's something you've got to worry about. What the researchers did in this study was they first looked for a target. They did a lot of analysis of the Staphylococcus aureus bug, and they found that this one protein, which is called RNPA, seems to be critical to this recycling apparatus. So then they had their first step. And the second step was trying to find some molecules that would disrupt it. And they did this screen with 30,000 molecules. And they found one, which they call RNPA-1000, which seemed to block the oxygen of RNPA. And in fact, this drug killed cells from all the major MRSA strains. And it was also effective in mice. Half of mice that were infected with Staphylococcus aureus recovered when given this drug versus none of the mice that weren't given the drug.
And toxicity to people?
Well, in fact, it was toxic when given in high doses to human cells. So the researchers say RNPA-1000 may not be the miracle drug for people, but something very similar to it might be. And at least this gives them a starting point for combating this very difficult-to-treat infection.
So another way of addressing the problem, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about why we go to war and also a gene that's been linked to how long birds migrate. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we're continuing our very extensive budget coverage, the impact of President Obama's 2012 budget request on various science agencies, and also some new insights into the anthrax case from 2001. A new study reveals that the scientific evidence used to finger the culprit behind the attacks may not be as strong as once thought. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site, and also be sure to check out the site for our coverage of the annual AAAS meeting that's happening in Washington, D.C. We're going to be covering a lot of the scientific sessions. We're going to be having live chats with rock stars of science, some of the biggest scientific celebrities at the meeting at noon Eastern time every day, and you'll be able to log in and submit your questions about everything from bat migrations to extrasolar planets to the latest in robotics. And Rob, I understand you'll be podcasting from the meeting too.
I will indeed, Dave.
So there's a lot going on. Be sure to check all of it out on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, and of course all the news from the annual AAAS meeting at news.sciencemag.org.